who can.
Okay, that's great. Well, thank you everybody for coming. It's a busy week and I'm going to try to keep my remarks brief. So I'm Jonathan Miller. This is where I'm located these days. We're building a physics department here right now. And recruiting is going very well, and I'm pleased to say that there are some names those of you in physics will know well in experiment and theory when they're publicly announced. We have a thriving biosciences division already, and that's also being built up. So I'd like to express my gratitude for the organizers for making it possible for me to participate in this workshop, and for their time and effort in coordinating. It's a very successful workshop. I'd like to thank the KITP workshop staff for their seamless administrative coordination. I'd like to take an opportunity to point out to you the workshop that I'm co-organizing with Gil McVane of Oxford this May. We have a number of speakers who many of you know, and we are anticipating admitting around 30 student participants. We had around 300 applicants last year for about 3 weeks, and we pay all expenses. Next year, based on discussions with one of the speakers here, I anticipate our topic will involve adding selection to this mix. I'm pleased to say that it looks like I'll be able to find a co-organizer from among the speakers here. So these things are built. Lab 1 is built. This is being built right now, as is are the other labs. But only Lab 1 is full. But Lab 2 will be open in about a year, and it will be full once it's opened. So the title of my talk is Algebraic Genomic Sequence Correlations by Implication There of Recombination. And so some of these phrases should be, words should be in quotes. Although I hope it will become clear shortly what I am talking about, I want to make it clear to the audience what I'm not talking about. Many of you know the Lee-Stanley long-range sequence correlations discovered about 20 years ago, and which have really been intensively studied ever since. And what I'm going to describe today is actually orthogonal to them, as in one can create a model that reproduces Stanley long-range sequence correlations, but doesn't reproduce the ones I'm going to tell you about today, and vice versa. Okay. Also, I mentioned the term algebraic. Well, genomes don't involve an asymptopia like anything real. In fact, genomes are relatively short, and the observation of a power law form is strictly only applicable in an asymptotic limit of some kind. Okay, so deviations are anticipated. Finally, recombination. By this, I'm going to refer quite generally to homologous processes of duplication and intra-locus recombination, which share a lot of their apparatus. And for details of this, we can discuss afterwards. Finally, the by implication is in quotes, because what I'm going to show is, in particular, is a distinction in the behavior of correlations in asexual and sexual organisms. And truly asexual organisms are very few in number. And finally, as an introduction, I'd just like to acknowledge my postdocs, Kun Gao, Maxim Korte, Betty Telfer, and Satish Venkatasan, and I'll indicate to you their roles as the talk goes on. So, an outline of the talk. Briefly, I'm going to introduce comparative genomics. This is probably a little off topic for you, although eventually the processes that you're studying have to lead to the outcomes that we see in present species, right? And so I'm going to give you a brief introduction, then I'll talk about the correlations of conservation. Then I'll move on to duplication length distributions, scale-free duplication dynamics, and if there's time, I'll talk about correlations of synonymous codon using oligosymbiont bacteria. There's much less here than meets the eye because the statements are very simple. So, brief introduction, and I'm sorry if many of you have thought about some of these things before, but we have a very practical goal in mind in comparative genomics. It's a field with biological, biomedical, and biotechnological impact, and the idea is we have sequences of whole genomes from hundreds of eukaryotes and thousands of prokaryotes, and we want to infer functionality of the sequence from sequence conservation. And I'd be happy to infer that the sequence is functional or not. Much more ambitious goal is to figure out what the actual function of the sequence is. But as you know, I'll show in a second, human genome, depending on whom you ask, maybe 6% of it is functional and the rest not. But many of us think that's improbable, and some of the data I'll show you supports that it's improbable. So the idea then is that sequence evolution, genome evolution, proceeds via point mutation and selection. Well, that's a little bit of a simplification, but it's a standard simplification for genome-wide inference of selection from sequence conservation. Okay, and what one of the things I want to show you is then the ways in which that can fail. And I would say the thinking, that means calculation, computation, and comparative genomics is largely uncontaminated by considerations of recombination, at least so far, except for maybe on beyond the megabase scales. So I think this is pretty fair for bacteria and for eukaryotes. Viruses, I don't know. So just to repeat myself, the notion of comparative genomics is that conservation of sequence implies functionality. And a little problem there, of course, is that you want to decide whether observed similar sequences between divergent genomes are similar by chance or because they're under selection. That's clear to everybody, right? In this audience, I think that's not something that I really have to say too much about. And as far as the impact of comparative genomics on biology, I think it's fair to say that about 10 years ago even, there were a large part of the biological community would saying that, well, there are protein-coding genes and their associated regulatory regions accounting for maybe a couple percent of the genome, and the rest of it just doesn't do much, if anything. And now, we all knew that was something of a simplification, but the question is whether those, the various exceptions that were known, were just flukes. Once the landmark human-mouse whole genome comparison emerged in 2002, and it was found that 5 to 6% of the human genome was strongly constrained, and we can discuss what strongly constrained means, but then it became more apparent to a larger group of biologists that there were some unresolved issues. We didn't know what this stuff done, but these other 4% did, except for a few anecdotal examples. And around 2004, a well-known paper was published by Halstead collaborators, and their observation, which I should say electrified the biological community, was that there are 481 pieces of DNA longer than 200 base pairs that are 100% identical between human, rat, and mouse genomes. And electrified by electrified, I mean that a large group of biologists have ever since been studying this set of about 481 segments by experiments and other methods as well. And there's currently a lot of disagreement as to whether these things are functional or not. Well, some certainly are. There have been some successful experiments. A number of these are actually enhancers. And the important thing from my point of view is that they are not proteins. Actually, I should tell you what I've plotted here, because this is a typical plot for the rest of this talk, which is that I'm going to plot on the x-axis a length in bases of a sequence, and on the y-axis the number of sequences of distinct sequences of that length, in this case conserved among these three diverse organisms. So the function of many of these sequences remains unestablished. And that brings us to really the first section, which is just to take a look at the rest of this distribution, which nobody had before we did in 2006. And this is what we saw. Again, this is the length in bases, and this is the number of distinct sequences of that length. The original Ultra Conservation paper that I just showed you, they specify a cutoff of 200 bases, but nobody can figure out where that number came from. You can ask the authors, and they deny any knowledge of where it came from. Most of these sequences at the time were unannotated. But up here, a lot of them, a third of them at least, are protein coding sequences. There are a lot of microRNA sequences in here. As I mentioned, there are enhancers in here. And in short, a variety of functional sequence or sequence that seems to be located near what people consider important regions of the genome, namely near transcription factor regulatory proteins.
Excuse me, didn't you say there were 481 elements of length 200?
Or about, yes, those would be these.
Ah, all of them together, of course.
All of them,
yeah. Sorry. Mm-hmm.
So one can ask, well, they looked at three species, and three's a magic number for them, but one can look at two, and so one can look at human and mouse intersections or human and rat intersections. One finds a neatly parallel line. Remind you what we would expect if we were looking at a point mutation process and if no selection, then on our log-log plot, we would expect to see something strongly curved in some way, something straight. And we see something which is pretty far from that. Now, for our purposes today, the notion of algebraic, whether something is really a parallel or not, is rather peripheral. That's important. I don't care too deeply about that. The notion is that it's way, way off exponential. So, one thing I like to show people is that, in general, if you look at the versions of genomes, and genomic data is far from perfect even these days. When somebody tells you the genome sequence is finished, you can be sure that in another 2 years somebody will tell you, oh, now it's finished. And even now, there are many parts of the human genome sequence that are far from being completed. But in general, what we find as we look, this is a comparison against mouse, as the versions of genomes improve, that they tend to converge to this form. Okay, so this is quite consistent.
Does it only seem to me that
that fall off is faster, steeper than?
Yes, it is. So that will be apparent here. So here I'm comparing mouse against a number of species, and the most conspicuous outlier, I guess, maybe is this rat. In fact, for very close genomes, one tends to get an exponential form, and I think we understand that, at least in part. I'll get back to that a little later. As one moves further away, we see for human, chimp, macaque, dog, and cow a nice set of parallel lines. At the time these were made, the opossum was not such a good quality. The chicken and frog assemblies were known to be disasters. They may be better now. Here is mouse against zebrafish and pufferfish. And they do have a somewhat distinct slope, and that's probably important. We can get back to this and discuss it later. So I mentioned that this is mouse against rat. The close genomes tend to show this exponential dependence, and I'd just like to show you that again. So one, in fact, doesn't have to compare exact, one doesn't have to make exact comparisons. One can make approximate comparisons, and one sees the same thing. In fact, nearly exactly the same shapes. And so just for variety, I'm showing you approximate matches according to equivalence in A and G and T equals C. But the figure is hardly distinguishable to the eye for exact matches except for a shift to the right. So this is human against chimp. Well, these are the primates, and this is the closest primate, and the further away you get, you see the exponential form seems to shift slowly. Here we have mouse again, and again the fish. So this is fairly typical. So I mentioned that one can relax the stringency and not require exact matching, and here I've done that. So we have a couple kinds of reduced stringency, and the observation I'd just like to make is the approximate parallelism of these three curves, which again is quite general, and suggests that whatever we're looking at is embedded in some kind of in some further structure that is less strongly constrained. Are we okay on this? Okay, good. So this is kind of a summary slide, little wordy, but basically just summarizing by a couple of methods. The red and the black are just different ways of looking for identity. This distribution of conserved sequences in rat, human, and mouse. And we're a loss in 2006. I don't know for how much better we're doing here, but I hope today, I hope some. Although we suggested it must be due to some kind of interaction. I'm not sure I see any way around that. Some kind of non-local interaction.
What's the sort of periodicity in that sorting?
So I mentioned that up here about 30% of these are proteins, and so we know the third base is degenerate, and that's exactly what these are reflect. So that leads me to the next section, which is we're baffled by these comparisons between genomes, and so we're wondering if maybe looking within genomes will shed some light on the matter. And so what we're going to look again for the first time, as far as I know, is exhaustively at the distribution of lengths of duplicated sequences, exactly duplicated, approximately duplicated, within your favorite genome. And this is mouse chromosome 1. So again, this is a self-alignment, which means we're looking for pieces that are duplicated at least once or one or more times. And the slope, again, I don't want to argue any fine points here, but this form is generic for mouse chromosomes, except for Y, which is supposed to be a little strange. The slope is somewhat different than we saw for comparisons between genomes. And one can look at chromosomes. These are the largest chromosomes of a variety of organisms: mouse, rice, human, chimp, worm, fruit fly, yeast. And the trend is fairly consistent, I think. And we can look at bacteria. Bacteria tend to be short, and so, you know, I don't want to argue this point. I'll show you some for which it perhaps seemed more convincing in a little bit. But I think that's why I put the algebraic in quotes. Finally, one question is whether this is an artifact of various technical methods, standard alignment, genome alignment methods. And it's not. One can do brute force intersection, comparing identical sequences among different genomes, and one finds essentially the same trend. So what's reassuring about this is that this is essentially a brute force result. We've identified all identical sequences between two genomes by searching both genomes. One question is whether these sequences that we're seeing within these distributions are actually typical or functional or.
You did the brute forcing within genomes, within one
gene. Yes.
Did you try it like between two?
Yes. And I showed you some plots of that before. It essentially makes no difference until you get to short lengths such that by chance you should find many copies. So what's nice about this is that right here I'm showing you from a whole genome self-alignment, I'm showing you the distribution of lengths of sequences that are parts of Hox genes. Hox genes are, as you may know, are very important. Are very important biologically. Okay, so that pretty much nails down the objection that we're looking at something trivial. Well, we're not, okay? What we've done here is just plot the Hox gene lengths and compare it to random samples from the parent distribution. And the correspondence is really excellent. I guess you could ask for a p-value, but I think that would be kind of silly. We'll get one if you want one.
Sorry, what's the sample set that went into this?
So what we want to show is that these Hox genome sequence lengths are truly drawn from this parent distribution, and not just that they look kind of similar. So we draw randomly from the parent distribution comparable numbers of sequences. So that is the second section, and we're close to not so far from being done. We have a model, numerical and analytical, that can account for these within genome similarities. I don't know if the model should be taken literally. So we have numerics, and for its dynamical model, and so for stationary and dilute limits, we can solve analytically. And so all we've done is to take a random sequence, which would be a chromosome, a long random sequence, and iteratively duplicate subsequences whose lengths are drawn from a specified source distribution. Okay? Ah, this is the wrong plot. This is the wrong figure. Sorry. This is a technical point. We can come back to it if there are questions. So all I wanted to. This is an example from human. And here we are. This is what I wanted to say. We choose a random position in the sequence. We choose a sequence of a specified length according to a specified source distribution. And then we substitute it somewhere else in the sequence. Okay? And we can delete it and reinsert. We get the same outcome that I'll show shortly. So the details of this are not particularly important. And so what we're going to do is we're going to continue this process until we get some kind of stationary distribution. And the first observation is that for certain choices of source distribution, we don't get a stationary distribution. So if the source distribution power gamma is much less than 2, and we can go through that a few times if you like, one never obtains a stationary distribution of duplication rates. Okay? And maybe you could have guessed this in advance. However, if the source power is greater than 2, then we quite consistently obtain a stationary distribution. And the exponent of that stationary distribution is the source exponent plus 1. Now, why is it plus 1? One can rationalize it by reminding oneself that these duplications actually interact because they can cover themselves up. So the idea is, you know, we're looking at effects of duplications over millennia, right? And so, of course, there's going to be a lot of overlapping, okay? And so it's kind of natural. For gamma sufficiently greater than 2, and on the assumption of a stationary state, we can derive the stationary state analytically in this assumption, which is that the duplications are dilute. Also important is that if one uses a monoscale source, one obtains a form that, again, we can compute analytically, and it's nothing like anything we see in genomes. Here is self-intersection of a cyanobacterium. And here is self-intersection of a random sequence of comparable length. And here is a steady state of our dynamics. Okay, so all I'm trying to show here, there are a bunch of parameters to play with, mutation rate, there are a few parameters to play with, and the point is not that this fit should be given any deep significance, but that we can fit, it's possible, it's within the observed distributions are within the purview of the model. Another nice thing is that it also reproduces the parallel structure of the distribution for reduced stringency matches, and this is not all trivial. So I showed you for intersections among diverse genomes how looking at approximate matches led to parallel shifts of this distribution. And the same actually holds for the self-intersections, for the duplication lengths. I didn't show you that, but it's in our manuscript, which is under review, and I can share it with anyone who's interested. And it's not entirely trivial to reproduce. So, concluding this section, we've just got one more. We've introduced a scale-free duplication dynamics, which seems in principle to be able to account for these observations. Again, I don't know how literally you should take it. Remark that a monoscale source is basically hopeless. Okay. It's interesting that, if you think about the total bases taken up by duplications, that is an integral, it involves an integral which diverges logarithmically when the number of sequences of a given length, goes as 1 over the length squared. So that gamma, the source gamma near 2 will lead to a critical gamma near 3, close to observed for most natural genomes. It's interesting that the variance of the total number of duplicated bases diverges as the genome length it goes to infinity. There's a logarithmic divergence. So I think that's interesting. So now I'm going to just talk about correlations of synonymous codon use. So when I mention third bases of codons, it's really easy speak for synonymous substitution. So third base of codon is written here, but I mean synonymous substitution. And so what we're going to ask is, are synonymous substitutions correlated in protein coding sequences? And the answer even a few years ago was, it's impossible. But people are finding at least single base features, although I don't know that anybody's looked at correlations. So the idea of using perfectly conserved coding, this title is not quite right, but what we're going to do is, or maybe not specific enough, we actually are going to take protein amino acid sequences that are identical between diverged genomes. And then the amino acid sequences are identical, and so now if we go back to the genomes, we can pull out the coding sequences, and now we're going to look for the differences in the coding sequences. Okay? And what we can do is to compare those differences to what one would obtain by randomly permuting the synonymous substitutions. Okay, so this is clear, right? It's a very simple idea. So again, codon degeneracy you're all familiar with. Basically, the point is that proteins impose a correlation on the nucleotide sequence, right? And if we're going to look for correlations in coding sequence, we've got to somehow subtract that out. We have to account for it, right? So these correlations arise from the choice of amino acids, and in particular the fact that some tryptophan has only one codon coding for it, others have 2, 4, 6 different codons. So, as we all know, changes occurring at the third bases, synonymous codons, not alter the amino acid, and so we expect them to occur independently of one another. And our objective is just to test the absence of this correlation in existing genome sequences. So again, we take our two genomes, and they're reasonably diverged, and we identify all identical amino acid sequences between them. We've got a 3-mer here, but this isn't much good unless we have dozens or hundreds long amino acid sequences shared. then we go back to the respective genomes and pull out the coding nucleotide sequences. And they, in general, will differ, we expect. And then we look for the length distribution of identically conserved coding sequences that we obtain. And we compare that to the permuted synonymous codons. We could ask, why do things this way? And the answer is, soon it won't be necessary when there are lots of high-quality sequences of individuals from populations. But that's only slowly happening. So for this, at this point, I don't know the better strategy. So we're going to look into oligosymbi bacteria, and some of these are maybe familiar from Christian Stoeffel's talk earlier last week. In fact, the inference that we're going to draw, mainly there's some kind of linkage at work producing correlations, is the same that he did. I don't believe his inference, and there's a sense in which I don't believe mine, but correlations are correlations, right, wherever they come from. So we look at a confirmed, generally agreed upon asexual reproducing bacteria. Basically, it's an endosymbiont of aphids, and there are fewer than 10 individuals per aphid. So you could well rationalize the notion that they really won't need their recombination enzymes, and they've lost them. It should be said that most reports of asexuality turned out to be wrong, but this one has held up for a number of years. Then we have an oligosymbiont that has retained all this recombination and repair genes. So we've got a rec minus and a rec plus. That's all I really want you to remember. Okay. And so, as advertised, and I don't want anybody to read into the log or semi-log plots here. I mean, I could plot them on a linear plot. Wouldn't be very helpful. I also apologize for the absence of error bars. They will be there. We have them. I just couldn't plot them. So in this rec minus strain, we look at the distribution of lengths of perfectly conserved nucleotide sequences, and those are the blue points. And then we look at permutations of the synonymous substitutions, and we get out the red and brown points. Okay, so there's nothing going on here, right? I don't even need an error bar, one might argue. But for the Wolbachia, it's a little different, and there's a substantial difference. And I think it more or less speaks for itself. Evidently, there is some correlation, right? Because if not, this is open too. And really, the only question is how deeply we care about it. And I guess I feel that this comparison to human mouse genomes kind of justifies a reason to that it might be of some general interest. I hope it's clear how this ties back to our original observation of this power law, where there are coding sequences sitting in there, right? And yet, these coding sequences, if the synonymous substitutions were occurring in an uncorrelated way among them, should have yielded a more steeply decaying contribution.
Have you looked to see if those ones way out there are particularly codon biased?
Well, the codon bias shouldn't make any. The codon bias shouldn't make a difference. The only thing that could make a difference, I guess, is. We believe we've canceled out the codon bias. That's the point. And
because you shuffle them within each gene.
Yes, that's right. So, Well, I have to say that I essentially have to...
Codon bias does vary across a gene.
Well, that's true. So we shuffle them within a gene, and that's absolutely right. So we don't know really what to do about the locally, you know, we shuffle them only within a gene, not between genes. But that's... although, again, it's a one-point function. So... but we're looking at a two-point function, right? We're looking at a correlation, we're not looking at one point.
Right, but I mean, just, you know, the beginning of the gene is more codon biased usually than the end isn't. So if you're mixing the substituted end into the beginning, then you're breaking up
the substituted pairs. So I have to think about it. So we're not merely scrambling codons within each sequence, we scramble the matched synonymous substitutions. So, right, because otherwise, yeah. Okay, we can return to we're almost done. I feel to some extent the association-rich recombination here may well be a coincidence. I don't know. On the other hand, the within genome comparisons I told you about, nobody really believes that these are occurring because of selection, right? So what one really believes is that chunks are getting duplicated and moved around, right? So in this case, you know, there's a strong case for a fairly concrete interpretation of the core of these distributions as chunks of stuff being moved around, right? Which is duplicated and moved around, right? As a bunch, right? That's the point. I mean, a duplication is not supposed to arise by point mutations, because especially along duplications. It's not supposed to be improbable. So the only way you can get it is if the thing moves as a correlated chunk. And that's what we believe we're observing here. As far as the intergenome algebraic decay, we suspect that clearly conservation, probably selection is also strongly acting, but we believe that we must be seeing something that was a bit frozen in, correlations that were frozen in before the common ancestor diverged. And these correlations presumably evolved over quite a bit of time, and how they occurred, I don't know if we really know yet. But especially with the coming availability of individuals from populations, I think we should be able to pin that down sometimes. So I'll just end with that outline, and thank you all very much for listening.
Do you think about what the track length distribution for gene conversion looks like?
That is, incidentally, this is Sidney Brenner's proposal to me. We have a bunch of people who made proposals about what's going on at London and Sydney's, and he thinks it must be gene conversion. One looks at the data on track length, and it's exponential, people say. But then you go look at the source of this data, and you realize there's no data. I mean, you know, you couldn't tell with the data they've got. So I think the individual data for individuals will pin that down, and I'm very anxious to get a hold of that wherever I can. I should also remark that I haven't had the chance to look at viruses, and that's because I tried very hard to look at the current HIV database, and then I learned last week from a lecturer that, well, those are sequences of populations, not individuals. But some of the other sequence databases may have suitable individual sequences, and so I think it would be of interest to look at the corresponding object there. Of course, in that case, it's presumably the mice jumping between two copies or whatever, I don't know. It's clearly different kind of recombination and one sees generally in bacterial eukaryotes.
So there are no comparisons in mutation accumulation lines which give you directly the distribution of duplication lengths? I mean, is there any decent data here?
So I'd be interested to know which lines you're thinking of. I mean, these things are changing pretty rapidly these days, and so what was there last 2 months ago might something else is here today. So I would be anxious to look at that. It's only a quick calculation. That's out of data. Okay, well, thank you again for your patience.